And when you notice a negative one, you might say, aha, the I'm not good enough story. Thanks, mind. Let yourself go. Is a biography of Nelson Mandela the same thing as Nelson Mandela himself? Clearly not. It is nothing more than a construction of words and pictures. And regardless of how true or false those words are, and regardless of the quality of the photographs, they cannot come close to the richness and fullness of the living human being himself. If you doubt this, then ask yourself, which would mean most to you, meeting your personal hero or reading their biography? The same principle holds true for all your own self-judgments and self-descriptions. The biography of you is not you. Whether your mind describes you with glowing praise or sums you up with scathing criticism, the words it uses are nothing more than words. And you may recall, in act, we're not too interested in whether those words are true or false. What we want to know is, are they helpful? If we allow these thoughts to guide our actions, will that work to make our lives richer and fuller? Now, if your mind is anything like mine, you'll notice that your self-judgments change like the wind. Some days my mind tells me I'm a wonderful father, a loving husband, and an excellent presenter. Other days it tells me I'm a lousy father, a selfish husband, and a pathetic presenter. There are days my mind says I'm a pretty good writer, and on other days it proclaims I write nothing but crap. The trick is not to get attached to either story, the positive or the negative. Whether your mind says I'm wonderful or I'm pathetic, I'm a winner or I'm a loser, I'm successful or I'm a failure, see it for what it is, just a story. What matters most in life is what you do, what you stand for, the way you behave. This is far more important than the stories you believe about yourself. If you doubt this, think about your own funeral. Do you want people to be saying, what I really admired about him was that he was there for me when I needed him. He supported me. He encouraged me. He inspired me. He was a fantastic role model. Or would you rather this? What I really admired about him was he had a very high opinion of himself. To quote the writer Margaret Fonte, one important thing I have learned over the years is the difference between taking one's work seriously and taking oneself seriously. The first is imperative, and the second is disastrous. Pointing the finger. Most of us are far too quick to judge others, to label them as quitters, losers, or failures. If we want to let go of judging ourselves harshly, we also need to do the same for others. The more we point the finger at our fellow human beings and write them off as weak or inferior, the more we entrench the habit of harsh, judgmental thinking. And sooner or later, our minds will turn those judgments back on ourselves. Life is easier when we recognize there are no such people as quitters, losers, or failures. There are just human beings who, much like you and me, sometimes quit, sometimes lose, and sometimes fail. Likewise, there are no such people as winners, champions, or successes. Rather, there are human beings who, just like you and me, sometimes win or are very successful in certain areas of their lives. Tiger Woods provides a good example. For years, he was idolized as a champion among champions, not only the world's top golfer, but the first athlete in history to earn more than $1 billion. However, in November 2009, revelations about Tiger's long list of extramarital sexual partners dominated news headlines around the world. Thus, in terms of playing golf, he was highly successful, but in terms of building a trusting, respectful relationship with his wife, he had failed miserably. At this point, your mind may start protesting. Yes, but others succeed more than I do, or I fail a lot more than others do. If this happens, come back to the workability question. If you hold on tightly to those thoughts, will that help you to be who you want to be and do what you want to do? I had to make this point to Michael, the businessman I mentioned earlier. Here's how the conversation went. Michael: but it's true. I am a loser. Russ: Michael, I am never going to get into a debate with you about whether your thoughts are true or not. I just want you to consider the situation. Your mind keeps calling you a loser, right? Michael: only about 10,000 times a day. Russ: and I have to be honest with you, I don't know any way to stop your mind from doing that. This is what minds do. They are quick to judge us and criticize us. Michael: Well, in my case, it's justified. Russ. Again, I'm not going to debate that with you. You've had lots of friends and business colleagues telling you that it wasn't your fault the company went down, and that you don't need to be so harsh on yourself and so on. Yet that hasn't made any difference whatsoever, has it? Your mind still tells you it's your fault, you're a loser, you screwed up. Michael. Yes, because I did. Russ. So here's the thing. If you hold on tightly to those thoughts and get all caught up in them, does it help you? Does it help you to deal with the situation, to start over, to rebuild your life, or does it just keep you feeling stuck and hopeless? Michael, long pause. Stuck and hopeless. Russ, so next time your mind starts judging you, what if you could let those thoughts come and go without getting all caught up in them? Would that be a useful ability? Michael, long pause. Yes, it would. I then took Michael through the techniques in this chapter, and I asked him to practice them regularly throughout the day. I specifically asked him to notice and name those thoughts. For example, here's Radio Triple F again, or aha, the good old loser story, thanks, mind, and let them come and go like leaves on a stream. When I saw Michael again 3 weeks later, he reported that he'd been practicing the techniques diligently and that he'd already developed a much greater sense of self-acceptance. He said that thoughts about being a loser were still showing up, but when they did, they hardly bothered him, and he usually found it quite easy to let them come and go. Michael's story reminds us that our self-judgments are not problematic in themselves. They only become so if we fuse with them. Note, this is very different from repeating positive affirmations such as, I completely accept myself. Remember that self-esteem research I mentioned in Chapter 3? It showed that when people with low self-esteem made affirmations of self-acceptance, they usually felt worse. It just got them thinking of all the things they couldn't truly accept about themselves. This approach gives us yet another rule for the confidence game. Rule 4. Self-acceptance trumps self-esteem. There's no shortage of hooks. We've looked at some of the mind's most common hooks, dwelling on obstacles, harsh self-judgments, comparisons to others, predictions of failure or disaster. But there are plenty of others: perfectionism, imposter syndrome, and rehashing old failures, to name but three. Perfectionism results when we get bullied by thoughts such as, I have to do it perfectly, I mustn't make mistakes, I have to do it right first time, or, if I can't do it well, there's no point in trying. If we let these thoughts boss us around, it's a recipe for disaster. We become reluctant to try anything new for fear we won't do it well enough. Or else we suffer from chronic stress because we're always placing such high demands on ourselves. Or we're continually disappointed or dissatisfied because we don't live up to our own high expectations. Imposter syndrome results when, although you are skilled at what you're doing, you get hooked by thoughts that you're not competent, that you can't do it properly, that you've gotten away with it so far but soon you'll be found out, that basically you're a fake, fraud, or imposter. Naturally, if you buy into these thoughts, it will shake your confidence. Yet another surefire way to undermine confidence is to replay and dwell on all your past failures. This readily leads to reason giving. It's always gone badly in the past. There's no point trying again. I failed the last two times, so why should this time be any different? There are many other patterns of unhelpful thinking, but we don't need to list them all because the principles are always the same. If a thought has hooked you and pulled you away from living the life you want, then notice it, name it, and neutralize it. At this point, you may be wondering, okay, but what then? After I've unhooked myself, what do I do? Excellent question. Chapter 8. The Rules of Engagement. Imagine listening to your favorite music with your ears full of cotton wool, or watching your favorite movie wearing dark sunglasses, or eating your favorite food while your tongue is still half numb from a visit to the dentist, or getting a back massage while you're wearing a thick woolen jacket. This is how we experience the world when we're all caught up in our thoughts. Remember the exercise called If Your Hands Were Thoughts from Chapter 5? When your hands were covering your eyes, fusion, you were missing out on the world around you. But as you moved your hands away from your eyes, diffusion, the world around you came into focus. You could see so much more clearly and take it all in. If we want to get the most out of life, we need to be fully present, aware, attentive, and engaged in what is happening. This involves a mindfulness skill called engagement, connecting with the world through noticing what we can see, hear, touch, taste, and smell. The If Your Hands Were Thoughts exercise demonstrates how diffusion and engagement are related to each other. As we diffuse from our thoughts, we can connect and engage with the world, take more in, and appreciate the present moment. Similarly, as we become present and engage in the here and now, we spontaneously diffuse from our thoughts. But what has all this to do with confidence? The power of engagement. If you want to have great sex, or a great conversation, or a great game of golf, if you want to write well, sing well, run well, if you want to speak well, negotiate well, or compete well, then you have to be psychologically present. You need to be engaged in what is happening. Suppose you're playing tennis, and instead of keeping your attention on the ball, you focus on all the thoughts inside your head. Am I holding the racket correctly? Are my feet in the best position? Wow, that ball's coming so fast. If your focus is on your thoughts rather than the ball, then what quality of game are you likely to play? Chances are not very good. If you want to play well, you need to keep your attention on the ball. Suppose you're making love, but instead of focusing on your partner, you're giving all your attention to thoughts in your head. How am I doing? I can't hold on much longer. Is she really enjoying this? What does he think of my body? If you're all caught up in your thoughts, you won't find it a satisfying experience, especially if your mind is giving a running commentary on how you're performing. If you want to enjoy the experience, you need to be engaged in what you're doing, appreciating the pleasurable sensations, tuning into your partner's responses, noticing the warmth and friction of your bodies, and letting your thoughts float past like clouds in the sky. When you're in the heat of that important interview, sitting in front of the panel, you need to be engaged with the interviewers. You need to be tuned in to what they are saying and how they're reacting. So the more attention you give to that commentary inside your head, duh, I shouldn't have said that. Oops, that didn't come out the way I wanted. Is this what they really want to hear? Uh-oh, I don't like the expression on her face. The harder you'll find it to focus and the worse you'll perform. In Chapter 1, I mentioned Cleo, a shy 28-year-old scientist who said that if she had more confidence, she would make more friends, socialize more, and behave in a more genuine, warm, and engaging way in social situations. Cleo told me that she found socializing quite stressful and often closed down or clammed up. There were several contributing factors, but the largest one was this. Instead of paying attention to the person she was talking to, she would get caught up in thoughts like, I'm so boring, I don't know anything about this topic, I hope this person likes me, or I've got nothing to say. And naturally, because she was so entangled in her thoughts, she found it hard to follow or contribute to the conversation and didn't get much enjoyment out of it. Cleo had lost touch with the fact that if we want to socialize well, we need to pay attention to the other person, to notice what they are saying, their facial expressions and body language, to connect and engage with them. When we say that someone looks confident, we have no idea what they are thinking or feeling, but we can observe what they are doing, how they are behaving. And one thing you'll always notice about confident people, they are very engaged in whatever they are doing. When they're socializing, they're thoroughly absorbed in the conversation. When they're playing sports, they're totally involved in the game. When they're writing a report, they're completely focused on the task. So whether we're talking about confidence, the feeling, or confidence, the action, engagement always plays a major role. Notice that in all the above scenarios, having negative thoughts is not the problem. The problem is that we are disengaged from our experiences. When we keep our attention on what we are doing and remain fully engaged in the task, then it doesn't matter what our minds say. Our thoughts only create problems if they hook us. If we let them come and go, then we can focus our attention on more important matters. Now, Pause for 20 seconds and notice what your mind is saying. Is your mind enthusiastic and cooperative, or is it just going with the flow? Has it gone quiet on you, or is it full of questions and objections? Here are a few concerns that often arise. Question. Thinking is very useful. Surely you're not suggesting I let go of all my thoughts? Answer. Not at all. If a thought is helpful, if it contains useful information that could help us to function better, perform better, and build a better life, then it makes sense to use it and let that thought influence our actions. However, in the foregoing examples, the thoughts are clearly unhelpful, so it makes sense to let them come and go. Question. But if I could just stop these negative thoughts from occurring in the first place, then there wouldn't be any problem, would there? Answer. For sure, and I'm willing to bet you've already tried that. And it didn't work, did it? And if you want to try harder, be my guest. Just keep in mind that not even Zen masters, after a lifetime of mind training, develop the ability to eliminate negative thoughts. Question. But when I'm in a challenging situation, it's hard to let my thoughts come and go. Isn't there an easier way? Answer. Riding a bike, driving a car, and using a pen all seem hard when we first start to learn them. Suppose I said to you, you know, learning to ride a bike at the age of 43 is so hard. I've got no sense of balance, I'm wobbling all over the place, I'm afraid of falling off. I didn't know it would be so hard. I feel like giving up. What would you say to me? Yes, it's too hard, Russ, you might as well give up. Russ, there's no need for you to actually get on the bike and practice. Just go and read some books about bike riding, and after that, you should be able to ride well. Russ, of course it's hard initially, but if you keep getting on the bike and practicing, then over time, it'll get easier. Learning mindfulness skills is much the same as learning to ride a bike, play the piano, or bake a cake. It may seem hard at the beginning, but it gets easier with practice. Fortunately, we can start learning mindfulness with simple, easy exercises. Indeed, some of the ones later in this chapter are almost effortless and can be practiced virtually any time, any place. This means we can progressively build up our skills little by little until we can be mindful even in the most challenging of situations. Note, I assume you've been doing the exercises in previous chapters. If not, please go back and work through them, as they provide a foundation for the work that follows shortly. We'll now talk a little more about the theory of engagement, and then we'll knuckle down to actually doing it. Don't just do something, be there. Time for a quick refresher. The golden rule of the confidence game is this. The actions of confidence come first, the feelings of confidence come later. Only when we can do something well are we likely to feel confident. But it is almost impossible to do something well if we are not engaged in what we are doing. If we just do it mindlessly, lost in our thoughts, or if we go through the motions on automatic pilot, then we probably won't do it very well. So how do we engage more fully in our experiences? Simple. We pay attention. We notice what is happening here and now. Paying attention is at the very core of mindfulness. But it's not just paying attention in any old way. Mindfulness means paying attention with openness, curiosity, and flexibility. Let's break that down. Paying attention. We pay attention to what is happening in this moment in both our inner world and the world outside us. In other words, we notice what we're thinking and feeling, and also what we can see, hear, touch, taste, and smell. Openness. We are open to what is happening, even if we don't like or approve of it, as opposed to turning away or closing off from our experiences. Curiosity. We are curious about what is happening. We actively seek to discover something new in our experience, something we may have missed or taken for granted. Like an intrepid explorer or an enthusiastic scientist, we pay attention to the details, taking nothing for granted, interested in whatever we may find. Flexibility. We are flexible in the way we pay attention. At times we may have a narrow focus, such as when we are absorbed in a task, threading a needle, drilling a hole, or hitting a golf ball. At other times we may have a broad focus, such as when we are exploring a new city and taking in all the novel sights, smells, and sounds. At times we may be more focused on the inner world of our thoughts and feelings, while at other times we may focus more on the external world. So how about we try this out right now? I invite you to stop reading for a few moments and simply notice what you can hear. Notice the sounds coming from you yourself, your breathing and your movements. Then expand your awareness to notice the sounds around you. Listen to these sounds as if you were a musician appreciating great music. Notice the different pitches, volumes, and rhythms. Notice how some sounds fade or cease, while others start or grow louder. Please do this now for 30 seconds. Next, I invite you to look around and notice five things you can see. Look at each object as if you were an artist studying a famous masterpiece. Notice the shape, color, texture, and shading. Notice any shadows, reflections, or highlights. Take 30 to 60 seconds to do this, lingering with curiosity on each object, no matter how familiar or mundane it seems. Now, sit up straight in your chair and notice the position of your body. Push your feet firmly into the floor, straighten your spine, and drop your shoulders. Take 30 seconds to scan your body from head to toe, noticing what you can feel in each part of it. Do this with intense curiosity, as if you were a scientist from another planet who has been granted the experience of 30 seconds inside a human body. Now, do all of the above simultaneously. Put the book down, sit up straight, plant your feet firmly and flexibly, focus your attention from your body to what you can see to what you can hear. Please do this now for 30 seconds. So what happened? Did you become more present, more aware of your surroundings and your body? When we're lost in a book, we lose touch with almost everything except those words on the page in front of us. However, those words are only one small aspect of our experience in the present moment. When we put the book down and pay attention to our bodies and our environment, we become aware of all sorts of sights, sounds, and sensations. Now, getting lost in a book is not a bad thing. Indeed, it's one of my favorite pastimes. But what if you were permanently lost in a book? Suppose that all day long you were walking around with your head literally buried in a book, holding it in your hands and reading it avidly at the same time as you were eating dinner, playing with your kids, making love, driving your car, playing tennis, or making conversation. How would that affect your life, health, and relationships? We all have a natural tendency to lead our lives in this manner. The only difference is that instead of being lost in a book, we are lost in all those words inside our head. Engagement means that in much the same way as we can put down a book, we let go of the words inside our head and pay attention to other aspects of our experience. The stage show of life. Life is like a magnificent stage show, and on that stage are all our emotions, memories, images, thoughts, and sensations, as well as everything we can see, hear, touch, taste, and smell. Mindfulness is like the lighting system. We can bring up the lights on any part of the show at any time so that we can see all the details. The lighting doesn't alter what happens on the stage, but it does affect how we perceive and appreciate the show. We have a lot of flexibility with this lighting system. We can dim the lights and shine spotlights on key areas of action, or we can bring up all the lights simultaneously and watch the entire show at once. The leaves on a stream exercise is like dimming the lights on the stage and shining a spotlight on your thoughts. And in the brief exercises you did a few moments ago, you played around with the spotlights, illuminating various aspects of the show, what you could see, what you could hear, and what you could feel. So, given that there are so many different aspects to the stage show, what should we focus on? The answer is simple. Focus on whatever is most important in this moment. Pay attention to whatever helps us be the person we want to be and do the things we want to do. As mentioned earlier, psychologists often refer to this as task-focused attention, being fully focused on the task at hand. If we want to perform any task well, whether it's golfing, painting, driving, making love, making lunch, or making conversation, our attention needs to be centered on whatever is relevant to the task. Negative self-judgments, predictions of failure, thoughts about not being good enough, these are not relevant parts of the stage show. But we can't get them off the stage, nor can we plunge them into absolute darkness. So what can we do? We can dim the lights a little on those areas and focus the bright spotlights where they're needed, on the lead singer, the musicians or the dancers, rather than on the roadies and the security guards. The exercise that follows will show you how. Mindful breathing. The practice of mindful breathing is thousands of years old. You can find it in religious, spiritual, and philosophical traditions as diverse as Hinduism, Judaism, Taoism, Buddhism, Christianity, Islam, yoga, Tai Chi, and many martial arts. It's a simple but effective way of developing engagement and diffusion skills, and you can do it for as long as you like, from 30 seconds to 30 minutes. If you've never done anything like this before, I recommend you start with just 5 minutes. Over time, you can increase the duration. A note of caution, if you have a long-standing habit of shallow, rapid breathing, then the slow, deep breathing of this exercise may at first seem odd or uncomfortable. However, if you persist, then within a couple of weeks of daily practice, it will start to feel natural and comfortable. Also, it's very common, but mindful breathing can occasionally bring up feelings of anxiety or dizziness for some people. If this happens to you, I strongly encourage you to persist. I guarantee you won't pass out, even if your mind tells you that you will. And within a week or two, such reactions usually disappear. Now, please read the instructions through twice so that you know what you're doing and then give it a go. And if you'd like a voice to guide you through it, I've recorded this exercise on Mindfulness Skills, Volume 1, available as a CD or MP3 from www.thehappinesstrap.com. Find a comfortable position, preferably seated upright with your back straight and your feet flat on the ground. Close your eyes or fix on a spot, whichever you prefer. Take some gentle, slow, deep breaths. Focus on emptying your lungs. Gently and calmly push out every last bit of air until your lungs are completely empty, and then allow them to fill by themselves. There's no need to take a deep breath in. Once your lungs are empty, they will automatically refill. See if you can simply allow this to happen, rather than forcing it. Observe your breathing as if you were a curious scientist who has never encountered anything like it before. Notice every little sensation, the air moving in and out of your nostrils, the rise and fall of your shoulders, the lifting and lowering of your rib cage, the rise and fall of your abdomen. Notice how all these elements interact effortlessly. After the first 10 breaths, allow your breathing to find its own natural rhythm. There's no need to keep controlling it. Your challenge is to keep the spotlight on your breath, to observe it flowing in and out of your body. As you do this, let your thoughts float by like leaves on a stream. From time to time, your mind will hook you and pull you out of the exercise. You'll get caught up in everything and anything, from ancient memories to daydreams to what you're having for dinner. This is natural and normal, and it will keep on happening. Each time you realize you've been hooked, gently acknowledge it and refocus on your breath. And if your mind starts to beat you up for not doing it well enough, thank it for those thoughts and carry on with the exercise. If uncomfortable feelings show up, such as frustration, boredom, impatience, anxiety, or backache, silently acknowledge them. Say to yourself, "Here's boredom," or "Here's frustration." Then refocus on your breath. Periodically, your mind is likely to grumble or protest. "I can't do it. It's too hard. It's boring." At first, these thoughts and many others will hook you and pull you out of the exercise. But they are really not a problem. No matter how many hundreds or thousands of times your mind hooks you, as soon as you realize it, acknowledge it, unhook, and refocus on the breath. Every time you do this, you are building a valuable skill, the ability to sustain focus. Once your time is up, expand your awareness to engage with the world around you. Keeping a spotlight on your breath also bring up the lights on your body and your environment. Push your feet into the floor, sit up straight, have a good stretch, and notice what you can see, hear, touch, taste, and smell. Once you have read the instructions at least twice, please do the exercise. 5 minutes is a good length of time to begin with, but you can do more or less than that if you prefer. Did you get hooked? How did you do with the exercise? If you've never done anything like this before, you are doing well if you last even 10 seconds before you get hooked and pulled out of it. When we are new to mindfulness, most of us are shocked at just how hard it is to stay focused, despite the fact that most of us have discovered certain activities in which we can maintain focus for long periods. These might include watching movies, reading books, having great conversations, or participating in a sport, hobby, or creative pursuit. But once you step outside of your comfort zone and try to focus in more challenging situations, for example, when you're learning a difficult skill or trying to meet a tight deadline, or you have to attend a meeting with somebody difficult, then you will usually find it much harder. So mindful breathing is an excellent way to improve your ability to focus. And naturally, the more you practice, the better you'll get. Does that last sentence give you a sense of déjà vu? The foregoing exercise is mindful breathing in its most basic, no-frills form. However, there are various elements that you can add to the exercise that might make it easier or more interesting. I invite you to try them out the next few times you practice and find out which approach works best for you. Option 1. Counting the breath. Count each breath you take, silently saying the number as you exhale. Once you reach 10, go back down to 1 and start again. If at any point you lose track of the numbers, simply start again from 1. Option 2. Colored breath. Visualize the breath flowing into and out of your lungs as if it were colored. You can imagine your breath any color you like. Most people choose white. Option 3. White light and dark clouds. You can imagine yourself breathing in white light as you inhale and breathing out dark clouds as you exhale. Option 4. Repeating words. You can silently repeat words as you breathe in and out. For example, you can slowly say, breathing in as you inhale and breathing out as you exhale. Or you might simply say, in and out. Option 5. Balloon breathing. You can imagine a balloon inside your abdomen that gradually expands as you breathe in and deflates as you breathe out. Anytime, any place. One of the great things about mindful breathing is we can practice it anytime, any place. I encourage you to practice it at red traffic lights, waiting online, during commercial breaks on TV, sitting on the toilet, when you arrive early for a meeting, interview, or social event, in bed as you drift off to sleep or wake up, when you're on hold on the telephone, whenever you have time to kill as you wait for a bus, train, or airplane, or for your partner to get ready, or for a movie to begin. On top of all these informal, mini-exercises, I encourage you to create a schedule for formal practice. For example, in the first week, you might set aside 5 minutes, 2 or 3 times a day, to sit somewhere quietly and practice mindful breathing. You might then increase the duration by 30 seconds each day until by week 3 you are doing this for 10 minutes 2 or 3 times a day. Keep in mind that every little bit of practice counts. Even 1 minute a day is better than none at all. To help develop the habit, you could use some simple reminders. Why not stick a label on your fridge or your car dashboard that says breathe, engage, or practice? You could also use your computer or cell phone. Set a reminder to pop up in your calendar each day. Another option is to put a brightly colored sticker on the strap of your watch or in your wallet or purse. This way, whenever you check the time or open your wallet or purse, you notice the sticker and it reminds you to take a few mindful breaths. You could also plan in advance. If you know there's a good chance you'll be stuck waiting somewhere, such as when attending a doctor's appointment or catching a plane, then make a commitment before you get there that you'll spend at least some of that time mindfully breathing. Breathing is just the start. Mindful breathing is a useful practice in its own right. It allows us to take some time out from our busy daily routines and often creates a restful state that allows us to recharge our batteries and find some inner peace. However, I'd like you to think of it as a versatile training tool to help you engage fully in every meaningful task in your life. When you're playing sports, working out, writing that book, making that sculpture, painting that canvas, playing that instrument, making love, playing with your kids, dancing at a party, making conversation, giving that speech, or negotiating that deal, instead of shining the spotlight on your breath, shine it on the task that you are doing. Engage fully in the experience and let your thoughts come and go like passing cars. And what if you don't like mindful breathing? Well, I encourage you to practice it anyway, because even if you don't like it at first, most people find that as time goes on, it gets easier and more rewarding. However, if you're absolutely opposed to it, there are many other ways of developing engagement skills. All you need do is stop and... Chapter 9. Smell the Roses. It is a 20-minute march from your cramped, gloomy prison cell to the limestone quarry. Once there, you will slave away with your pick and shovel under the searing sun, your hands blistered and bleeding, your body drenched with sweat and plastered with dust. How would you feel if you were on that march, knowing what lay in store for you? In his autobiography, Long Walk to Freedom, Nelson Mandela described this march as a tonic. For 13 of his years in Robben Island Prison, he did it every single morning. And as he did so, he engaged fully in his experience. He noticed the birds flying gracefully through the sky, the cool caress of the wind blowing in from the sea, and the fresh smell of the eucalyptus blossoms. He wasn't lost in thoughts about the hard work ahead of him or the miserable days behind him. He was living fully in the present moment. Fortunately, we don't have to be locked away in prison to appreciate the birds, the wind, and the flowers. If we stop rushing around on automatic pilot and use our five senses to connect fully with the world around us, we will find much more fulfillment. Yes, we all know the saying, stop and smell the roses, but how often do we actually do it? The exercises in this chapter all involve engaging through the five senses, noticing what you can see, hear, touch, taste, and smell. This is to help you develop your ability to stay present, focused, and absorbed in whatever you are doing. As we have discussed, this ability is essential if you want to do anything well or find it satisfying. Mindfulness for busy people. I have occasionally met people who had too much time on their hands, but I have to say they are few and far between. Most of us are busy, busy, busy. Many of my clients tell me they don't have time to practice all this stuff. Indeed, I often have the same thoughts myself. But the beauty of mindfulness training is that you can do it anytime, any place. Sure, if you're going to sit and do a formal exercise, such as 10 minutes of mindful breathing or 10 minutes of leaves on a stream, you'll need to make some time for that, and I strongly encourage you to do so. But throughout the day, there are all sorts of opportunities for practice without having to alter your daily routine. Following are a few suggestions. Engaging in your morning routine. You can turn any part of your morning routine into a mindfulness training session. Brushing your teeth, shaving, going to the toilet, having a shower, getting dressed, making the bed, making breakfast, eating breakfast, having a cup of tea, and so on. Specifically practice developing your engagement and diffusion skills. For example, if you're making a cup of tea, engage in every little step of the process using all five senses. And observe what is happening with the utmost curiosity as if you've never done it before. Notice all the different sounds involved, listening to the changes in pitch, volume, timbre, and rhythm. The crescendo of the kettle filling up, the sharp click of the on switch, the rumble of boiling water, the hiss of escaping steam, the swoosh as you pour the water into the cup, the trickle as you lift the tea bag out, and the gentle splosh as you add sugar or milk. Notice all the different visual elements, including shapes, colors, textures, and light and shadow. The thick rush of steam spouting from the kettle, the misty swirls of steam rising from the water in the cup, the light rippling on the surface as you dunk the tea bag, the dark stream of tea diffusing through the hot water, the fluffy clouds of milk billowing up to the surface. Notice all the different body movements required, the effortless interaction of your shoulder, arm, hand, and eyes as you're lifting up the kettle, turning on the tap, replacing the kettle, pouring the water, dunking the tea bag, and so on. As you do this, see if you can discover something new, something you previously took for granted. Have you ever truly paid attention to the patterns of steam rising from your cup, or the sound of the spoon clinking against the side, or the movement of your shoulder when you dunk a teabag? As you do this practice, your mind will try to hook you with thoughts about all the things on your to-do list. Let those thoughts come and go like passing cars, and engage in what you are doing here and now. Of course, from time to time, your mind will pull you out of it. The moment you realize this, gently acknowledge it, unhook yourself, and engage once again in making the tea. Engaging in a chore. Are there any dull, tedious, or mundane chores in your life, things that you just have to do to make your life work? Do you grit your teeth and rush through them as quickly as possible? Or do you do them mindlessly, going through the motions on automatic pilot? Or do you try to make them less boring by listening to the radio or watching TV simultaneously? Common examples might include ironing clothes, doing the washing up, stacking the dishwasher, putting out the garbage, making lunch for the kids, vacuuming, doing the laundry, sweeping the floor, scrubbing the bathtub, and so on. Any of these chores provide valuable opportunities to develop engagement and diffusion skills. Remember Seb, the taxi driver, afraid to make love to his wife? Seb recognized that if he ever wanted to enjoy sexual activity again, he would have to learn how to engage fully in the process instead of getting lost in his anxious thoughts and feelings. So he chose to turn stacking the dishwasher into a mindfulness practice. I said to him, "Next time you have to stack the dishwasher, imagine you are the world champion of dishwasher stackers, and your performance is being videotaped and beamed live to hundreds of millions of TV sets around the world." I asked him to place in every single cup, plate, bowl, spoon, knife, and fork with the greatest of care, to put each item down gently, noticing the sound it made as it slotted into place, to notice the colors and patterns that food and drink have left on the various surfaces, to notice the movements of his shoulder, arm, and hand. And I reminded him, as you do this, let your mind chatter away like a radio in the background, and whenever you get hooked, acknowledge it, unhook, and refocus. At our next session, Seb reported that he had tried this approach, and much to his surprise, stacking the dishwasher had turned into an engaging activity rather than a task of mindless drudgery. "Don't get me wrong," he said, "it's not like it's turned into fun. If I had a choice between watching football and stacking the dishwasher, believe me, football would win hands down. But it's different when I do it mindfully. I kind of get absorbed in it. It's weird. It's kind of interesting. I didn't think stacking dishes could be interesting." Engaging in a pleasurable activity. Each and every day we do many things that are potentially very pleasurable, but we fail to maximize the enjoyment and satisfaction of these experiences because we're not fully engaged. We take them for granted or do them on autopilot while thinking about what we have to do next. Common examples include eating, drinking, playing with your kids, stroking a pet, having a shower, or hugging a loved one. We also miss out on many simple pleasures simply because we're too busy to stop and smell the roses. What could you do, simply and easily, that could add some pleasure to your life? Could you go for a walk in the park and appreciate the birds and flowers? Could you listen to more of your favorite music? Could you cook something special? Could you add a bit of spice to your sex life? Each day I invite you to practice mindfulness of at least two pleasurable experiences. If you're having a shower, use all five senses to engage in it. Notice the patterns of the droplets on the shower screen, the sensations of the water on your skin, the smell of the shampoo and soap, and the sound of the spray coming out of the nozzle. When you're eating dinner, pause for a moment before your first bite and notice the different aromas of the various ingredients and the colors, shapes, and textures of the different foods. Then as you cut up the food, notice the sounds made by your cutlery and the movements of your hands and arms and shoulders. And as you eat that first mouthful, notice the tastes and textures in your mouth, as if you were a gourmet food critic who has never tasted a meal like this before. If you're hugging someone you love, notice the sensations in your body and the way you position yourself and what you do with your arms and the reactions in the face and body of your loved one. Engaging in anything and everything. As you can see, there are countless quick and easy ways for busy people to develop mindfulness. And remember, you can put literally anything in the spotlight and practice sustaining your focus on it. From tying your shoelaces to blowing your nose, from watching a sunset to washing your hair, from mowing the lawn to scratching your backside. Not that you'd ever do that, of course. So invent a few engagement practices of your own. From mindfully stocking the fridge to mindfully walking up the stairs, from mindfully combing your hair to mindfully unlocking the front door. Remember, every mindful moment makes a difference. The more practice we do, the less we'll wander off into... Chapter 10, Psychological Smog. I could hardly believe my eyes. I was walking through the botanical gardens in Melbourne, but I could have been just about anywhere. A few minutes earlier, I had been surrounded by magnificent trees. Presumably the trees hadn't moved, but now I could not see the slightest trace of them. The smog had obliterated everything. Melbourne is a beautiful city, and fortunately it very rarely suffers from smog attacks, but when it happens, it's dramatic. And if you've ever been caught in smog, fog, torrential rain, a blizzard, or a dust storm, then you'll know how frustrating it is. It's hard to get where you're going when you can't see clearly. Still, at least when we're trapped by the weather, we know it's happening, and we can modify our behaviour as required. But when we get trapped inside our psychological smog, it's a different story. Psychological smog is what it sounds like, a thick cloud of thoughts that prevents us from seeing clearly or acting effectively. And sadly, most of the time, when we are lost in this smog, we don't even realize it. It's only once the smog lifts and we reconnect with the world and start to see clearly that we recognize how lost we really were. Psychological smog takes many forms. Worrying, blaming, fantasizing, rehashing old rejections and failures, planning escapes, plotting revenge, daydreaming, rehearsing conversations, analysis paralysis, dwelling on times long gone, and predicting the future. And if we're not mindful, we can spend hours wandering fruitlessly through this smog, all the while missing out on our lives. But there's one thing we need to be clear on. The smog is not created by our thoughts. It is fusion with our thoughts that creates the smog. In other words, no matter how negative, unhelpful, or painful our thoughts might be, they will not create smog if we are diffused from them. But the more we fuse with them, the thicker the smog, and the more we lose contact with the world around us. The only way out of the smog is through engagement and diffusion. The instant we unhook ourselves from those thoughts and engage fully in whatever we are doing, we can see clearly and take effective action. The worry smog. One of the most suffocating forms of psychological smog is worrying. We all worry to some degree, but the more habitual it becomes, the more it drains our vitality. It wastes time, saps energy, and gets in the way of effective action. All the clients I've mentioned so far wasted plenty of time worrying. Raj worried endlessly about the possibility of losing money with his new restaurant venture. Seb worried about whether he would ever be able to have good sex again, and whether or not his wife would leave him if he didn't satisfy her. Sarah worried about screwing up her auditions, and Cleo and Claire both worried a lot about being rejected or clamming up in social situations. All of these people reduced their worrying significantly using the techniques in this chapter, but at no point did I say to them, "Stop worrying about it." In my opinion, that's one of the most useless bits of advice you could possibly give someone. After all, if it were that easy to stop, they probably would have done so long before we so wisely suggested it. In fact, many of my clients complain, "I try to stop worrying, but I can't." Comments like this don't surprise me. There's a lot of research now that shows that trying to stop worrying usually just makes it worse. When we push away worrying thoughts, or distract ourselves from them, it often gives us some short-term relief, but in the long term, it generally leads to a rebound effect, where those thoughts return with greater frequency and intensity than before. So how then do we deal with the worry smog? Step 1. Be clear about what worrying is. Worrying does not mean having thoughts about bad things that might happen. We all have such thoughts, and as with any other form of psychological smog, the thoughts themselves are not the problem. The problem is fusion. Worrying means fusing with those thoughts, holding on tightly to them, replaying them over and over instead of letting them go. Step 2. Identify the costs of worrying. The major cost of worrying is missing out on life. When we're all caught up in our worries, we are not psychologically present. We are disconnected from our here and now experiences and are instead caught up in thoughts about the future. We miss out on interaction with our loved ones. We miss out on the food we are eating or the activities we are doing. We go through the motions, but we are not present, so the experience is not rewarding or fulfilling. And it certainly interferes with our performance in any field of endeavor. Note, fear and anxiety do not interfere with performance, but worrying does. Other costs include wasted time, disrupted sleep, and procrastination over important decisions. Step 3. Unhook from reasons to worry. Sometimes my clients say to me, "That's just me. I've always been a worrier. I can't help it." I usually reply, "If you go along with that story, where does it leave you?" It's quite natural that your mind would say something like that. Our minds tend to get very set in their ways, and they often don't like making changes. So how about we let your mind say that change is impossible, and let's give it a go anyway and see what happens. Another classic story I often hear is this, "But worrying helps me." The story usually goes that worrying is helpful for dealing with my problems or preparing for the worst. I reply that worrying is like riding a rickety old bicycle. It will get you from New York to Chicago, but how long will it take you, and what condition will you be in by the time you get there? There are far more effective ways to make this journey, with an excellent new bicycle, or by car, bus, or plane. If we want to effectively solve our problems, or effectively make decisions for the future, or effectively prepare for action in the event of worst-case scenarios, then worrying simply does not do the job. It typically impairs action, increases procrastination, reduces motivation, and leads to poor decision-making, while increasing stress and anxiety. Instead of worrying, move to active planning or constructive problem-solving, using questions such as the following. What can I do to deal effectively with this situation? What action could I take that might make a difference? Where could I get help or advice? What's the worst thing that could happen? If it did happen, what could I do to cope? What actions could I take, or help, advice could I get? If you can take effective action, do so. If you can't, then make room for your discomfort, diffuse from your worries, and engage in doing something meaningful here and now. Step 4. Distinguish worrying from taking care. Many people seem to think that worrying about their problems equates to taking care of their problems. But there is a huge difference. The former is useless, the latter invaluable. Here are a few examples. Worrying about your health. Uselessly dwelling on scary stories about what might be wrong with your body. Taking care of your health. Eating well, exercising, stopping smoking. Worrying about your finances, uselessly dwelling on scary stories about how little money you have, or how you might lose it, or what you may be unable to afford. Taking care of your finances, starting a savings account, setting a budget, meeting with a financial advisor. Step 5. Defuse from worrying itself. Our mind is like the world's greatest storyteller, and all it wants is our attention. And it knows that we pay attention when it tells us scary stories. So it's not going to suddenly stop doing that. But we can learn to let those worries come and go without buying into them. One simple technique is to notice and name. As soon as we become aware of worrying thoughts, we silently say to ourselves, "Here's worrying again," or more simply, "Worrying." And if it's worrying about a recurrent theme, you might also try thanking your mind and or naming the story. Aha, here's the going bankrupt story. Thanks, mind. Or here's the lose the race story. Thanks, mind. Also, regular practicing leaves on a stream or mindful breathing is extremely useful for chronic worriers. From smog to confidence. Any mindfulness technique is helpful for escaping from any form of psychological smog. In the previous chapter, I talked about simple ways of developing mindfulness skills in everyday life. We're now going to tie all this in to your major life goals. First, a quick revisit of the confidence cycle. Consider for a moment, in which fields of endeavor would genuine confidence make the most difference to you? Sports, business, social, creative, or something else? I invite you now to choose one of these fields, whichever one you'd like to focus on first, and think about it in terms of the confidence cycle. To improve what you do in this field, what skills will you need to actively work on? The confidence cycle, or how to get good at doing anything. 1. Practice the skills. 2. Apply them effectively. 3. Assess the results. 4. Modify as needed. For example, in sport, you may need to practice a particular technique, maneuver, or movement, such as a golf swing or a tennis serve. In business, you may need to practice your presentation skills, interview technique, or sales pitch. In socializing, you may need to practice telling jokes or stories, asking open-ended questions, or sharing more of yourself. In painting, you may need to practice mixing pigments, drawing up perspective grids, or experimenting with light and shadow. In parenting, you may need to practice giving positive feedback, being assertive, or engaging your kids on their level. Often we are reluctant to accept the need for practice, but there's really no escaping it. Our minds may protest, but it's not fair. Some people are naturally talented. They don't have to do all this practice. Why should I? I have no doubt that such thoughts are true. All humans are not born equal, and some are naturally talented in certain areas. We can see this even in young children. Some are naturally stronger, faster, more coordinated, more imaginative, better with words, and so on than their peers. The important question is this: if we hold on tightly to this thought, will it help us do what we need to do to improve, or will it just set us up for frustration and resentment? I must admit, I often feel envious when others get better results than me, with apparently less effort, such as successful novelists who write one book each year, and it only takes them 3 months to do it. However, I usually unhook myself quickly from the "it